It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Between 2020 and 2022, there were at least three separate incidents when a Milwaukee police officer's firearm discharged without anyone pulling the trigger, resulting in serious injuries.
In 2022, the Milwaukee Police Union sued the city over safety concerns around these firearms, the Sig Sauer P320s.
The union withdrew the lawsuit after the department announced that all of the firearms would be replaced with Glock 45s, and the Milwaukee Common Council voted to approve the funding.
Rather than being destroyed, the Sig Sauer guns were then sold back to the supplier, effectively putting them in the civilian marketplace.
But if these guns are deemed unsafe for police officers, should they be sold at all?
Ava Sasani is a reporter for the Gun Violence Data Hub at The Trace, where she's talked to more than 40 police departments around the country to learn more about the use of Sig Sauer P320s. Her latest piece is called A Gun Deemed Too Dangerous for Cops but Fine for Civilians. Ava, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
You report that, as we mentioned, in the span of just a couple years, we had three incidents in Milwaukee, a couple, I think, on body camera, where this pistol would fire without the trigger being pulled. Can you describe a couple of these incidents?
Yeah, the most recent was the one that we opened our story with. It was captured on body cam footage. You know, it's a little bit dark, so it's tough to see, but from what we can witness from this body camera footage, these two officers are inspecting this vehicle, and then all of a sudden, one of their guns goes off, and you hear a scream from the person whose perspective we're viewing from. It's very startling. By all appearances, it seems like the hands of the officer whose gun went off is nowhere near the trigger, and that's sort of what started this story that my colleague and I worked on.
Milwaukee is not the only police department to encounter this. How widespread are these concerns?
It's all over the country. We have, outside of law enforcement, we have over 100 allegations of people being injured by the P320. In October of last year, we had one person allegedly killed by a P320 firing accidentally. All over the country, this gun is incredibly popular with law enforcement. So we're seeing departments like Denver, Chicago, Oklahoma City, all reevaluating their relationship with the P320 in light of these new allegations.
Now, in your piece, you note that the manufacturer of these firearms denies that they're defective, that there's a problem with them. What have they said in public statements?
Yeah, Sig Sauer, which is the company behind the P320, they're based in New Hampshire. They have pretty consistently maintained that these reports are all actually user error. And, you know, with any gun, there are risks. And the company has said that all of these incidents were a matter of negligence, and the gun itself is totally safe to use. They've been pretty limited in what they've said publicly, but they have not wavered from that statement that it's all safe and this is all just negligence on the user's part.
In October of 2022, just a month after one of these incidents, the Milwaukee Police Department decided to replace the P320s. Here's Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson speaking at a press conference in that month.
Last month, there was an issue of unexplained discharges from Milwaukee Police Department firearms, and it was brought to my attention. And I made it clear at that time that there's no higher priority than the safety of the people who protect our city.
And that, again, Milwaukee is not alone there. How common is it for police departments to replace this make and model of firearm?
It's tough to say exactly. We interviewed over 60 police departments over the course of 2 months. And we found about a dozen that decided to do this trade-in process that Milwaukee ultimately opted for. But we know there are police departments that we didn't get to, smaller departments. There was recently an investigation out of Washington that found a bunch more police departments that decided to make the swap that, you know, we just couldn't reach. Within Wisconsin, there are at least two departments, likely more based on my conversations with the state's Fraternal Order of Police. But we know for sure Milwaukee PD and Hobart Lawrence decided to make the switch in light of these safety concerns.
We're talking about safety concerns around the Sig Sauer P320 pistols used by a lot of police departments, previously used by the Milwaukee Police Department, despite multiple incidents of these guns firing, apparently without anyone pulling the trigger. We're talking to Ava Sasani, reporter for the Gun Violence Data Hub at The Trace. Ava, I want to get to the heart of your new report on this. What happens to these firearms after a police department, like in Milwaukee, stops using them?
So a very common practice that we've known law enforcement departments do for a while is they will pay for new guns by trading in the old ones. It's similar to how when you have a used car, you can put the value of that old car towards a new purchase. Many, many police departments around the country, including Milwaukee, do this with their guns. So they'll go back to the dealer and say, hey, what can you give us for these old guns that have been used for however many years? And then we'll use that money as a discount for the upgrade. In this case, I think what is particularly concerning about trading in P320s is the department themselves have decided that the gun is too risky after all these multiple accidents being reported for their own officers with a great deal of firearms training to use. So it's a little bit concerning that indirectly they're putting these guns back on the civilian market. And as we said, Milwaukee is certainly not alone in that. There are departments all over the country that have done this practice. Of the 60 plus that we interviewed, only one, a small department out of Connecticut, decided that even though they normally trade in their old firearms, because of the concerns with the P320, it would not be ethical to do that with a potentially risky firearm.
And as you report in your piece, if you're looking for a used firearm, formerly used by a police department for many people, is a selling point. It's like it's the same. It's the actual firearms that the police department decided to use. You know that it's probably been well taken care of and maintained over the years. So that label, if people aren't aware of these concerns about the Sig Sauer P320, might actually look like a real positive, right?
Absolutely. You can get these firearms at a pretty good price because they're used, and you know there's a bit of an appeal to it because it used to be in the hands of a police officer. We see these all over the secondhand market that, you know, gun sellers will lead with the fact that it used to be owned by a police officer. And I think even if you're aware of the let's say allegations against the P320, I think there is a perception that has still, you know, not been punctured by these reports that it really was user error. And if, you know, if I'm a gun buyer looking for a good deal on a secondhand police gun, I might be enticed to buy a P320 that used to be used by Milwaukee PD or whoever else, because I do believe what Sig Sauer is saying, and I do believe that all these incidents really can be chalked up to negligence on the part of the user.
You write that there have been various lawsuits, including civilian lawsuits against Sig Sauer, making these claims that the P320 fired without a trigger pull. As I read your piece, it sounds like those have had mixed results. What have we seen in the courts when this gets argued?
Many of these lawsuits are thrown out. They're dismissed because in order to win a suit like this, first of all, it's incredibly difficult in the United States to sue a gun manufacturer. Gun lobbyists have really successfully created these shields for gun sellers like Sig Sauer. So for a while, we saw many of these lawsuits being dismissed. Sig Sauer did win one jury trial a couple of years ago, but we're starting to see, I think, a shift in late last year. Two juries awarded the people suing Sig Sauer damages. And all told, Sig Sauer had to pay a cumulative $13 million to people who alleged that the P320 had issues. So I do think as litigation continues against Sig Sauer, it'll be interesting to see if that shift continues or if we go back to this pattern of having many of these cases dismissed or settled out of court.
as you mentioned, you only came across one police department, a smaller one in Connecticut, that said, hey, we're not going to return these guns, get that discount, have them go back to civilian hands. Did you get any sense that there's movement among police departments, whatever state regulators, whatever the case might be, to take a closer look at what happens to these weapons that police departments say, hey, they're too dangerous for our staff to use, to stop them from going to the public?
Honestly, among the law enforcement departments that we interviewed, no. I think the impression is we as police officers are not responsible for deciding what guns can or can't be sold. That is the responsibility of lawmakers, which, you know, it is technically true. But I think the trouble comes from when you have an industry that is, I think, not regulated in the same way that any other consumer good would be regulated. There gets this nebulous responsibility or hope, I think, that we have of the people that are sworn to, you know, protect us, that they would be conscious of what might happen to their old guns. I will say in Milwaukee, after we published the story, Alderman Peter Bergelis did write my editor a note saying that they were going to look into this practice. They're going to try to understand exactly what happened to the P320s and look at more broadly the practice of reselling police guns. So there is a bit of movement there, I think, but within police departments and law enforcement agencies, no, honestly, I think there is still that understanding that that is outside of their purview.
Ava, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ava Sasani, reporter for the Gun Violence Data Hub at The Trace. We've been talking about safety issues surrounding the Sig Sauer P320, formerly used by police officers in Milwaukee, and why these firearms end up going back into the civilian marketplace.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, meet a student growing hundreds of pounds of hydroponic greens in her high school cafeteria and the Green Bay company that developed the growing system that schools are using.
We grow lettuce because we find that it's what produces the fastest for us that we can use the most with our school lunches.
Indoor gardens without soil and fresh food at the salad bar. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Across the Mississippi River on the Wisconsin border, a student at Winona Senior High School is growing up to 200 pounds of lettuce each month for school lunches and doing it all inside the cafeteria.
The greens are grown in a hydroponic garden called a Flex Farm. It was developed by a Green Bay company that we'll hear from in a bit.
These gardens were meant to be a learning tool, but they've turned into a serious source of school nutrition for more than 800 students, and the district aims to expand that program to their middle school.
Miriam Jackson is a sophomore at Winona Senior High School in Minnesota and student farm manager for her school district. And Jennifer Walters is the district school nutrition director for Winona Area Public Schools. Jennifer and Miriam, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Miriam, let's start with you. Can you explain us the basics of what a hydroponic garden is and what you're up to in the school cafeteria?
Yeah, so it's a virtual garden that has a constant 24/7 flow of water in it, and it also has a light tower in the middle that runs for 16 to 18 hours a day. So the water is constantly running on the roots of the plant, and then the plant has sunlight, but then it also kind of has this night period where it's dark, so it simulates a real garden scenario.
And so what are you growing in it? So what kind of lettuce? Can you talk a little bit about what it grows?
Yeah, so we grow lettuce because we find that it's what produces the fastest for us that we can use the most with our school lunches. And we kind of grow all types. This year was kind of a trial year to see what grows fastest, what grows best, and what grows the fullest.
What's the tastiest lettuce to you?
I like the iceberg.
Jennifer, how have the high school students responded to having greens grown in their cafeteria?
Oh, they really like it. I was out at lunch today, and I noticed that when we serve our Fork Farms lettuce, that the students really make beautiful salads. That's fun to see. So they're actually building more salads is what I've seen. And as a dietitian, that makes me happy that they're getting local produce.
As you are growing, what kinds of factors do you need to keep an eye on when you're taking care of these plants?
It's the water. So all the nutrients and all the pH that the plants get come directly from the water. So it's monitoring that there's enough water for the farms to circulate properly, and then making sure that there's enough nutrition so that the plants are getting the minerals that they'd normally get from soil, as well as the pH, so they're getting enough acidic that they need to grow properly.
How does the cost compare as you look at the inputs of water and other things? How does it compare to simply buying greens to use in school lunches?
Well, we started buying greens from a hydroponic garden because I wanted to make sure that we served some local produce. So I was paying $20 a pound.
Wow.
For the greens. I know. So we had two of the farms already. And I thought, you know, why don't we just expand this and start growing more of our own? So it's been a cost savings in that respect.
Miriam, do you have a background in agriculture or what got you involved in this?
I do not have a background in agriculture, so I got in it through FFA. So FFA had those two original farms that Ms. Walters was talking about earlier, and I was kind of part of that system. And then as they grew over the summer through grants that they received, when they grew to six farms instead of just the two, I continued to stay involved with it.
Has this project made an impression on you? Does it make you want to do more of this?
Yeah, it definitely has. I'm definitely looking at programs that relate to it. And I think it's also just taught me a lot about looking at agronomy or plant science, or even just in the future, growing produce, as well as understanding where our food comes from.
Jennifer, Miriam has been watching these plants grow, cultivating them. How have you seen Miriam grow over the course of managing this project and these systems?
You know, Miriam is amazing. I told her she was a born leader. She's the one that brings the ideas and we carry it forward. So she's growing really into a great gardener, great student. I'm looking forward to see where she ends up.
And one idea that has been floated is to expand the program to the district middle school. How might that look different at the middle school level? What would you need to make that happen, Jennifer?
Well, we would need to train our staff at the middle school because we would likely start with one farm. Unfortunately, our middle schoolers are not great lettuce eaters. So I'm hoping by starting with one farm, they can see, you know, how much fun it is to see the lettuce grow and have it on their plate. So we'll start with one farm over there. And eventually the students at the middle school, because they do study hydroponics in their science class, I'm hoping that they will become a part of this as well.
Miriam, do you have thoughts on a hydroponic succession plan in the works? Like who will take over when you're no longer able to tend the system?
Yeah, I was definitely going to gauge that next year, whether it's an individual student, a group of students, or even just a class that the agriculture teacher runs to see if there's a group of these kids that really does want to see more about this and is able to get involved.
Okay, Miriam, so if you were in a blindfolded taste test and someone put iceberg lettuce from the grocery store in front of you and someone put the lettuce you've grown in the hydroponic system, could you tell a difference?
Yes, because the difference is how fresh it is. You're able to tell the difference from this right to the farm, right to lunch, because some days we'll harvest and that will then be served the next day. You're able to tell the difference between that and then the shredded processed stuff you buy that has been picked a while ago.
What do your friends say when you sit down at the lunch table? You're all going into digging into your salads. Do you get feedback from your friends?
Yeah, they'll always say, look, Miriam, it's your lettuce. Just little stuff like that, and I think it's awesome.
Well, Jennifer and Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you.
That is Miriam Jackson, a sophomore at Winona Senior High School in Minnesota who runs the hydroponic gardens program at her school, and Jennifer Walters, the school nutrition director at Winona Area Public Schools. Now we're joined by the Wisconsin company that creates these hydroponic growing systems, including the one that's in use at Winona Senior High. Alex Tank is CEO and co-founder of Fork Farms in Green Bay. Alex, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You came up with a hydroponic cultivation system called Flex Farm. What problem or unmet need did you see when you set out to design the system?
This actually goes back almost two decades now. It was when I was living in New York City. I was brought up in Appleton, Wisconsin, and found myself out in the city. And I was actually out there trying to pursue a music degree and ended up randomly getting connected to a rooftop garden in Brooklyn. They let me take home food that I had grown on this little rooftop, and my eating habits changed. And they changed so much that it actually helped me through some depression and anxiety I had going on at the time that I didn't even really recognize I was dealing with. And so I thought to myself, man, is it really that simple? You grow food, you're more likely to eat that food, and then you eat the food and you feel better. And so the whole mission of Fork Farms and of the Flex Farm is to figure out how can we give people access to high quality, fresh and affordable food, make it really easy for them to do it themselves and to really take the power of food into their own hands.
How does your hydroponic garden then lend itself to an education setting, to schools?
Well, when you think about schools, you know, they tend to be the largest restaurant in a given community.
Yeah.
They serve so many meals, and they have such a critical role that they play in local food systems. And so when we thought to ourselves, you know, who are the people that we want to try to positively affect the most? It was kids, because if kids aren't eating well, they aren't thinking as well, they're not learning. And, you know, we really believe that learning is a real foundation for a productive and healthy society. And, you know, as we were doing our work, we just saw a huge opportunity there to, you know, assist in improving school lunch and, you know, assist in the learning environment at the same time. But the reality is, because they move so much food product, that a little tabletop unit or a little hobbyist system isn't going to do it. We really wanted to provide a solution that was going to feed kids and feed the school. But you have to make it where your average school teacher or nutrition services director
or a student
can do it themselves. Or student, of course, you know, obviously can do it themselves. Yeah. And so and that's the big piece that you just brought up, is creating programming like curriculum and lesson plans and hands-on opportunities. Like, that's really where the magic is when you get, you know, kids that really take this into their own hands and come up with something creative that we even wouldn't have thought of. I mean, that's when you really know it's working.
What is the uptake like here? Have Wisconsin schools adopted your product for use?
Yeah, we've been so fortunate. Now there are over 800 schools in the state of Wisconsin alone that are doing this, and we're placing systems and programs like this in all 50 states and 12 countries now, believe it or not.
Wow, you've really scaled up. These systems, they require electricity, they require water to operate. Is that resource usage a concern or a barrier for these products?
You know, with a system like ours, you're able to recirculate the water supply. We don't just water the plants once and then the water goes away. We reuse that water over and over and over and over again. So all you're doing week over week is just topping up your system. And that actually makes it 50 times more water efficient than conventional farming. And so especially in areas where water is a huge concern, that's a huge selling point. But what it really is big, especially in Wisconsin, is energy costs. A lot of folks have tried, you know, greenhouses, but heating a greenhouse in the winter is really expensive. Or they try, you know, some other solution that, you know, the lighting is really expensive. And so we spend a lot of time focusing on how do we make our solution as energy efficient as possible. And that really drives the cost of the food more than anything else. And around 8 years ago, we stumbled into this realization that just by recapturing the light from the little grow light that's in the middle of the system, The light bounces around in there and it doesn't escape. And as a result, you don't need to put as much light into the system. Hmm. Well, come to find out, it's actually 75% less energy is what you need, which is disruptive. And so we've got schools all over the country that are telling us, like, yeah, we're only spending 65 cents, 80 cents a pound for products that they're buying off the back of the truck, you know, anywhere from $6 to $12 per pound. And so, you know, that's another piece of this. It's not just an educational opportunity. It's really an opportunity for schools to save money and to enhance their food budget and really improve school lunch as a result of that.
And it sounds like you're still finding some technological breakthroughs here to these systems, and they are still evolving and being optimized.
How that's looked over the last couple of years is we started off really with, we were kind of a one-trick pony. We had this really cool product called the Flex Farm. It's still, you know, a huge part of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But people started coming to us and being like, we really want to go big. I mean, we've got this whole school district. It's 20 schools. We want to make it where the whole district never buys salad greens ever again. Hmm. We were like, wow, that's great. You know, you need a farm of this size. And that went really well. And so then we had folks coming to us that were saying, wow, we need a farm that's like 2,000 square feet. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And we realized that The Flex Farm, it's this pod shape, you know, for your listeners, it's like a cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to open it up and you pull the light tower out. And it's great for small installations. But at scale, when you think about a commercial scale farm, it's really not designed to take most optimal use of the square footage. And for harvesting, it's really perfect for those smaller institutional farms. So we actually formed a partnership with Rockwell Automation, which is headquartered in Milwaukee. And we ended up developing an enterprise solution on the hydroponic side that we call the Flex Acre, which is this giant wall-looking system. And we actually developed it to mimic data center design, because data centers are something that we build all over the world right now as humans. And we have learned how to really efficiently heat and cool them. And that problem has plagued our industry for many years, figuring out how do you heat and cool these vertical farms where you're stacking tiers of plants one on top of each other. And it's a nightmare because you're trying to create a consistent temperature and humidity and heat rises. And so we looked at who has already solved this problem and let's talk to them and let's work with them, as opposed to trying to create our own solution that's going to be less effective. And as a result, we now have this very robust enterprise commercial type solution that is really growing like gangbusters. We figured out how to make it where anybody, if they, you know, Kate, if you wanted to build a 10,000 square foot vertical farm somewhere, I could just tell you, all right, you're going to have to put a sub panel there and a water line there. We're going to roll your farm in, drop it and plug it in. And it just works.
Wow. Wow. Plug and play almost. Switching gears to business climate. How is the ongoing trade war and tariffs affecting your business and your supply chain?
We are very fortunate in that we built our business on the ethos that if we're in the local food business, we need to be in the local manufacturing business as well. So we actually do the vast majority of our manufacturing in the state of Wisconsin. And as a result of that, we have been able to keep our prices really stable. We haven't had really any supply chain disruption related to trying to get things from overseas. But, you know, when you think about raw material, you know, we use plastics and steel and things like that. I mean, those prices are inevitably going to continue to rise. And so we just need to be prepared for that, because the last thing we want to do is, you know, put that onto our customers. We want to minimize that as much as we possibly can.
Okay, so crystal ball time, and whatever's inside this crystal ball is green, right?
Yeah.
Where do you see Fork Farms a decade, 2 decades from now? What does the future hold for you in Green Bay?
I really think that the way that the world is evolving, the way that food is grown is evolving. I mean, most people don't know that the average number of miles that a piece of food on your plate has traveled is over 2,000 miles, and it's touched on average more than 30 hands. I mean, it is a very complex, very large system, and so many of the costs are structurally embedded in the way that food moves around. And so, you know, when you think about the rising population globally, you know, we're welcoming all these new people every day. When you think about all the health disparities that exist, when you think about the rising gap between the haves and the have-nots, when you think about The fact that climate change is already reducing crop yields, where the majority of our produce and fruits and vegetables is grown in Salinas Valley, California, and Yuma, Arizona. There is a real math problem that we're facing, all of us, where food prices, especially for fresh food, are going to continue to rise. It's inevitable. And so how do we all together build a better food system? And I think that the future is in communities getting more involved and taking the power and the control of that back into their own hands. And we're going to see it with the people that really care about food the most, you know, and I think those are educators who want to do the best for their kids. And those are healthcare professionals that want to do the best for their patients. And these are the people that we're partnering with right now that are, you know, starting to do that. But I have been shocked, you know, we've been in business 8 years, and I have just been shocked year over year at how many people there are actually out there that are willing to engage in this type of thing. And I really think that the more that we've grown, that there is a real future in the food that we eat 10 years from now, 20 years from now, is actually going to come from down the street. And it's not going to have traveled 2,000 miles. And it will be grown in a facility that looks a lot like a data center, and in a way that's really clean, and in a way that's really safe, in a way that's very energy and labor efficient. And that's our mission. You know, that's what we're going to try to do, is just make fresh food more accessible for everybody.
Alex, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That is Alex Tynk, co-founder and CEO of Fork Farms in Green Bay, which produces the Flex Farm. That is an educational hydroponic garden that is used in schools all over the country. Earlier, we heard from a high school student and nutrition director in Winona, Minnesota, where they produce greens from a hydroponic garden system, growing system in the school cafeteria.
Still ahead, a new children's book is a powerful celebration of the strength, resilience, and beauty of Black girls.
Our young Black girls or girls of color can many times be inundated with images or things that make them feel less than. And so always being able to affirm yourself is just a way to combat that.
The Milwaukee author of Dear Black Girl, I See You, that's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new children's book by a Milwaukee author celebrates the strength, resilience, and beauty of Black girls everywhere.
Dear Black girl, guess what? I see you. Yes, all the pieces that make up your world.
Ebony Haynes writes positive affirmations for girlhood and growing up Black and brown.
I see your beauty, your dreams, and your scars, too. I see you. I hear you because I am you.
Haynes collaborated with Milwaukee illustrator Jasmine Grant. The new book is called Dear Black Girl, I See You, and it's a follow-up to the 2019 book, Dear Black Boy, It's Okay to Cry. Ebony and Jasmine, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. I'm excited for this.
Ebony, let's start with you. The title of these books begin with the words that you'd normally see in a very personal letter to someone with the word dear. Is that the intention? Were these books like writing a deeply personal letter to someone you love?
Yes. So as the author of both Dear Black Boy, It's Okay to Cry and Dear Black Girl, I See You, both books were actually personal letters. One was to a loved one of mine and the other was to myself. And so both were actually letters written to individuals that then were turned into stories.
And you encourage Black girls to jump around, do your dance, laugh out loud, and declare, I love me. Why do you think I love me is freedom?
Because so often people will try to get us not to love ourselves. We live in a world that just sometimes is full of negativity, negative images, negative media. And so often our young girls, more particular are young Black girls or girls of color, can many times be inundated with images or things that make them feel less than. And so always being able to affirm yourself is just a way to combat that, to understand that regardless of what others may say or think, that if you love yourself and if you honor yourself, that it can take you into a place of freedom and liberation from what other people may think.
And Jasmine, you know, every page is so full of tenderness and love with these illustrations. What was your stylistic goal when you took on these books?
I think my goal was to be very specific, even though the words are general. You know, it's specifically to Ebony, but it's also the people who read it should be able to see themselves in it. And I wanted to create a diversity of Black girls and make it so they could really see themselves, see their features. And also, I like to have images that make you think. So some of the images aren't very straightforward. It's especially for Dear Black Boy, It's Okay to Cry. It was really enjoyable listening to people get their own interpretations out of the images and, you know, giving them that participation. And I wanted to continue with that idea in Dear Black Girl, I See You.
Sometimes illustrators don't even meet the author. Do you two have a relationship over the years?
Yes. And so actually, Jasmine and I now, we've known each other for 6 years now. When I was writing Dear Black Boy, I was new to this. I lost a cousin to suicide. And as I mentioned, wrote a love letter to him. His name was Bryce. And I wrote the words, but when I knew I wanted to make it a children's book, I'm like, but I don't know how to draw. And so I reached out to a friend and asked if they knew anyone. And Jasmine had just done an event at their boutique and was like, I met this cool girl who draws really well. You should meet her. And literally we met and the rest was history.
She was preggers during the first book. And that was an experience watching her jump into motherhood. On top of the book stuff. And it was a good relationship for me because it was also my first time illustrating a children's book. So I like to think that we worked through understanding how to do this together.
Ebony, in Dear Black Girl, there's one line. It says, Daddy once said, baby girl, don't let the world take the good out of you. And I kept wondering and going back to that page, are those words familiar to you?
Yes. And so those are actual words from my dad, Robert Haynes. He passed away actually in the midst of writing and illustrating this book. And so one of the things that I remind myself of are like those voices that continually encouraged me on my journey. And his voice is one of those voices that I just always remember him telling me I was amazing, I was beautiful. And one thing he would always say when I was younger, you know, were those words, you know, don't let the world take the good out of you. And I was like, what? Like, what does that even mean? And as I grew older, boy, did I learn what those words mean. You know, so often you live and you learn that many times when you're trying to do good, when you're working really hard, it just is like these forces or people are, you know, just like constantly sometimes against you and you wonder what that is. And you just recognize like it's a part of the journey and a part of the growth. And that if you can sustain all the things you go through and still remain good and pure in the end, like that's a really, really great thing to find some hope and some honor in. So.
And Jasmine, if you look really closely at this page, as I did, I studied it, there is a poster in front of the class and it says, don't let them dim your light. And then underneath it's Robert Jasper Haynes Jr. Can you talk about that poster and illustrating this page?
Oh, Ebony specifically asked me to put that in there, you know, her father.
Yeah, I love it.
I think when we were talking about it, we're talking about the fact that she speaks life into women and she does that. Like her father spoke life into her and she's using that. So I'm kind of drawing Ebony doing what she does, speaking to people, giving them a place to be heard. That's a big part of this page and doing that work that this book hopefully will also help her do.
We're talking about the new children's book, Dear Black Girl, I See You, with Ebony Haynes, Milwaukee-based children's book author, and Jasmine Grant there, the illustrator of this book, and Dear Black Boy that came out earlier. Ebony, it's been 5 years since a Minneapolis police officer murdered George Floyd, which led to, of course, a national reckoning, racism, police misconduct, Black Lives Matter. Would the words be any different in Dear Black Boy now? What are you reflecting on?
So what's interesting is I wrote the book right before, I mean, in 2019, right before the pandemic, right before a lot of those things that you spoke to happened. I work in education, and so I serve young people and families, and I've been doing so for quite a while now. And I mean, I don't think the words would be any different. And I think that's part of, you know, that's part of I don't like to use the word challenge, but, you know, that's part of the struggle that so often so many face. But then it's also a part of the joy and the hope. I always share with people, you know, I write very specifically to Black and brown children because their stories matter, right? I know that children's books don't always reflect everyone positively. I know that, you know, some young people may look at books and never see themselves reflected. And so I write very intentionally, but I also always remind readers that you should be able to read my story and get something out of it the same way I should be able to read yours and get something out of it. So I also try to share that they're not exclusive titles in the fact that, like, if you're a person, if you're a human, you can read Dear Black Boy and still feel the words that are on the page. But to recognize that because of some of those things you mentioned, what happened with George Floyd, thinking about the uprising of Black Lives Matters and just what's happening in our nation now, like the diminishing of histories and things like that, you get to a point where you recognize if there was not power in your story, why would someone be trying to erase it? And so just being vulnerable enough to be the one to say, we have to write these stories, we have to tell these stories because they do matter. And so that children everywhere can see themselves reflected in a positive light. And so the words, I think, would be the same. But I do think that things like that many times give the words more power and just bring them to life more. Because even if you look at some of the pages, they reflect those things happening in our nation before they were actually happening. But we've also lived in this nation, many of us, for, you know, some decades and know, like, this isn't the beginning of some of those things happening.
I appreciate how in Dear Black Boy, you pose a couple questions. Do you know you are a king? Do you realize that you are in charge of your destiny? And I thought a moment about MLK in King, and then you go on to talk about dreaming. And I'm wondering, what are you wanting your young readers to contemplate in those moments?
I think it's a part of that. I really want young people and really anybody, right? My cousin was an adult at the time of his passing. And I think, you know, there are so many defining moments in our lives. And I really want readers to understand, you know, like, you have power. You have the ability to, you know, dream something and then go out and bring it to life. I want them to understand that no matter who they are, what they look like, where they come from, that they are worthy, that they are valued. In those affirmations, you know, I think that's why I chose not to write a story, but to write a book of affirmations, because they're lifeless, they're timeless, right? Hearing an affirmation at my age means the same as a five-year-old hearing it, right? It may be from a different context based on what I've been through or what I've experienced, but it's still to hear someone say, I love you, I see you, you matter, dream big, go for the start, right? To hear that, it never expires. And so I really wanted to create something that was timeless, similar to an MLK, who, although Martin Luther King Jr. is no longer here, his words still ring true today. We still honor that every single day in who we are and the work that we do in this country. And so I think that's really the goal, is that our youth and our families and anybody who reads the book would see themselves as timeless beings who just have so much power to go out and make so much more of their lives.
Jasmine, I'm wondering, when you were illustrating some pages, there is a black boy and a black girl. Other pages, there are silhouettes. And I'm thinking about in Dear Black Girl, the page about being a nurturer and how that comes easy. But it also shows a girl who is sweeping and serving food and drying a dish in the kitchen. How did you reflect upon the use of silhouette versus putting an illustration of an actual little girl?
So the silhouette is supposed to be kind of like the girl's shadow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a traditional straightforward shadow. It's not on the ground from their body. But I don't know if you've heard of the concept of shadow work that some people engage in now. The idea that you have parts of your personhood that you're not aware of or you're ashamed of or you're trying to hide or are hidden from you. And I like the idea that those aspects of yourself are not bad. In fact, they are powerful and they deserve to be seen specifically by you. You know, your shadow could be something you're ashamed of, but it could also be just that, you know, inside of you, you have the desire to sew, you have the desire to sing, but, you know, life has kind of gotten away from you and you haven't been able to focus on it. It might be that you have the desire to be heard. You want to be a public speaker, but you feel like you have to be shy because the world thinks you're too loud. You have to be, you know, quiet and demure. The shadow is something that needs to be seen. And if we give it the attention it needs, it can embolden us and make us stronger. So when we were coming up with the illustration for that, especially in Dear Black Boy, there are silhouettes, but not quite the same. They're those blue images of the boys.
Yeah.
Those were supposed to represent emotions because that book was about giving a voice to your emotions or giving the respect to your emotions that they deserve. For this one, I wanted to have a similar trope, but shadow work is what I came up with because, you know, shadow is kind of playing with what's seen and what's not seen. And this is encouraging Black girls to see every aspect of themselves, even the ones that might upset them or might upset others.
Ebony, is there another book in you?
There is. I've started writing the next. Actually, it's two that I'm kind of co-writing because one is a children's book and then one is a self-help parent book, but about the same thing. So my son has hearing loss. He was born with sensory neuro bilateral hearing loss. I know more about the ear than I thought I would. And I am writing about him and our journey and what I've learned being his mom, what I've learned about children with special abilities and how to love them and how to teach them and how to advocate for them. And so I'm kind of writing two at the same time, one that will be a children's book that he'll write with me, and then one that will be a self-help kind of parent motivational book of just how I made it through my journey. Of parenting my son, Daxon.
Ebony and Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for this time today.
That is Ebony Haynes, a Milwaukee-based children's book author, and Jasmine Grant, a Milwaukee illustrator. Their new children's book is called Dear Black Girl, I See You. It is a follow-up to the 2019 book, Dear Black Boy, It's Okay to Cry. Tis outdoor music season in Wisconsin, and lots of communities around the state have some kind of free concerts going on. Rob, do you look forward to this time of year?
I do, and I've already gotten out to a festival to see some music at a park this year.
How about you? Do you have a favorite local concert series, or perhaps it's a festival, a block party? Maybe you want to put in a plug for it. Tell us about it.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888 642-0232.
And if you're looking for music and other cool cultural events, WPR has you covered on that end. Check out our event calendar online at wpr.org/events.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Beatrice Lawrence, and Avery Lee Rogers.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.